You know, Angela Davis has come to Madison several times over the years.
I've heard her.
And she spoke once in the Humanities Building, and just, you know, it was located in Humanities. And I remember her asking people for a show of hands of people who had been involved in the anti-war protest movement and, you know, black student movement. And because it was Madison, you know, we were active at that point, lots of hands went up. Mm-hmm. This was at least 10 years ago, I'm sure she'd asked this. And then she wanted a show of hands of the people who had shared information about their protest experience with someone in the younger generation. And there was only one or two hands. And her point was that it was important for us to pass on our experiences to the younger ones so that they wouldn't have to repeat the same stuff and so they could, you know, benefit from the firsthand information. And I just thought it was a very telling inquiry, you know, particularly when there were only one or two hands up. And my hand wasn't up because I hadn't purposely told my children. I mean, they hear about it from time to time, but I hadn't sat down and said, this is what we did during the movement, because people are so busy living their lives and they move on to other points.
I think we do the same thing with our children. We take for granted that they're going to, you know,
pick it up, and
they probably know some of the stuff. They know we're doing this, but we need to talk to them.
That's why I think that doing this kind of thing is very important. So I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, thank you. I did. That really brings me to that first question, was a little bit about your family background, where you're from, and if your family was involved at all in the civil rights movement in that era, during that time, and how did you become involved in this?
I was born in Chicago and grew up on the near north side, which is now in a yuppie-fied time called River North.
Oh, okay.
I lived for a very long time in Cabrini Green housing projects, especially before the gangs came in. We moved into Cabrini Green in 1955, and my mother moved out in about 82. So we were there for almost 30 years, I guess, 20-something years. So that was home to me, even when I was going to school here. Mm-hmm. I have 2 degrees from here. I came here in 67 as an undergrad.
Oh, okay.
And went to law school in 75. But at any rate, I'm from Chicago. I was very active in various organizations and protest movements in Chicago. I went to public schools, and I was also active in Chicago youth centers, which are like neighborhood centers.
So were you, let's say, active as a high school student then?
Yes, I was. I was active. I marched in when Dr. King came to Chicago. Mm-hmm. I joined those marches, and I've always been an activist. I think it grew out of, in school, it grew out of what was called extracurricular activities, because I would finish my assignments early, and then I would always volunteer for other things. And so I think the activism in the community just grew from that. Plus, being involved in Chicago youth centers helped, because you know, there were a number of student groups, and we had a newsletter to work on, and that's where I got involved in dance and things that meant a lot to me. But protests and those kinds of things, especially around the civil rights movement, was just something that I did. I even marched in a march one time when I was on crutches and had a cast.
What was that? Is that here?
No, it was in high school.
In high school, oh wow.
I had operations on both my knees in high school, and I was near the end of recovery with one of these, and there was a march. And, you know, I'd planned on going in the march and, you know, thought about it and talked to my doctor, and I wasn't in pain at that point. So it was me and my crutches and my cast. I remember that so vividly, but, you know.
But was your family supportive of this involvement?
Yeah, they were. I remember my grandmother, I'm fortunate that we have five generations alive in our family. And we have four direct generations. I just returned from a family reunion. It's every Memorial Day weekend. And both of my grandmothers are in their early 80s and doing quite fine. But my maternal grandmother is a very feisty, opinionated, strong-willed woman who is not, she doesn't put people off in that way. You know, she's, those are really attributes for her. And she worked at one of the local hospitals until she retired. And I remember that they were unionizing the laundry workers. And she was very involved in that. And I remember her discussions about co-workers who wanted to cross the picket line and that kind of stuff. And she was, needless to say, not up for that at all. But it's, it just seemed to me, I mean, I've always believed in the civil rights movement, so it's like, why not do it, you know? Why not go out and march? Why not contribute in the way you could?
Yeah, and that's part of my thesis is really, I think, even Afro-American studies and all these kinds of, and particularly that in particular had, it was kind of a result of the civil rights movement. And even though it, you know, things have changed over the years, but...
Oh yeah, they're all part and parcel, they're an extension. Mm-hmm. So that's in a simple way, my family background.
Tell me, how was it that you came to come to UW-Madison? You came as an undergraduate, freshman?
Yeah. I was fortunate to get into the Upward Bound program, and I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Sure.
Okay, and there was an Upward Bound program at Mundelein College in Chicago, Mundelein College in the Near North Side, and I was admitted and became very involved in the program. I was a student in it until I graduated. And then I actually went back and worked two or three summers after I was while I was an undergrad.
Could you spell that?
Mundelein. I don't know what it is now. At the time, it was a women's Catholic college in Chicago.
So you were Upward Bound, but you were in high school.
I was in high school. And the Upward Bound program is designed to help children, young people transition from high school to college or from high school to whatever else they're going to do.
So they start in high school and even junior high. Like
that's,
they have some.
Okay. Yeah, and for ours it was high school. Mm-hmm. But in Upward Bound, because I was, college aspirant, Upward Bound tried to take you to the campuses so you could meet people where you were applying. And so I applied to University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. I applied to University of Colorado in Boulder. And I applied to Wisconsin. And I went to visit all three. I was fortunate enough to, because we were very poor. So I really loved Colorado, and I have an uncle there. And I just fell in love with it. But they weren't going to give me any financial aid. There was grant or scholarship, and I had a strong GPA because they were giving their money to people from their region, and they were really cute. They were like, "Where's Chicago?" let's see, Boulder, Chicago. And so they told me that if I went there, I could, but that I would end up borrowing about $10,000. And the thought of being that much in debt when you're poor. You know, it's absolutely repulsive. It's just out of the question. It's kind of like starting zero and going down. I would owe you how much? I mean, I remember thinking, nah, I don't think so. And so I came to Wisconsin because I wanted to get away, and Illinois was like going nowhere. I mean, it was like going downstate. So, and also Wisconsin, the five-year program was just starting, although it wasn't called the five-year program then. And Ruth Doyle was administering the program. So one of the reasons that Wisconsin appealed to me is because the student body was large. And, you know, when we were thinking about colleges, they would, you know, tell you, Upward Bound would advise you to consider the kind of community it was and how large it was and how diverse it was, not just in terms of ethnicity, but what kinds of interests do you have that this school could meet? And I realized that I needed a larger community because I'm very active. So I didn't want to go to a small place where I would become bored.
Yeah.
And Wisconsin was very large.
And Boulder would have been not small.
Yeah, and it's close to Chicago, which quite frankly is why I've stayed so long, because my family's in Chicago. And I didn't like Madison when I came, typical reasons.
Well, tell me those reasons. I mean, what was the climate like? Were there other Afro-American students
there? Yeah. I enjoyed the university, but Madison per se, I didn't know much about it, so therefore, you know, I probably was prejudiced to some extent, but it just, you know, it seemed to me that it was best for people studying political science because the state government and city government is very active and the county government, or if you traveled a lot and because you could be assured that your property would be relatively safe because crime was relatively low here. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember, it was a third reason why I thought, you know, those would be the top three reasons to be here if you're not in school.
Were you studying public science?
I majored in American institutions, which doesn't exist now, I understand, or is being phased out. It was a major, actually, it's where the Afro-American Studies Department came from, too. It was a major that was a unique major where you would study the primary institutions in this country and therefore learn about the foundation and structure of the country. So you study the religious institutions and the political institutions and the labor institutions and the educational institutions, etc. And it... And then in that major, you would write what was called a parathesis to graduate. Mm-hmm. And I was never interested in being an expert in any particular field. So majoring in poli-sci or history or English didn't appeal to me because I never cared. It's not challenging to me to know everything there is in one discipline.
Yeah,
and so I'm really interdisciplinary. I want to know all the basics and as much as I can about a variety of things so that I can draw upon them in the ways that I need to use them.
And that's something that's catching on now.
It's
Everybody's interdisciplinary now.
And I was, so that, I'm fortunate that they had a vehicle for me because I don't know what I would have done if I'd had to be confined to one or two disciplines. I'm sure I would have majored in two. I mean, just by by definition, I wouldn't have just had one. But they had American institutions, and so it was a large student body. It was relatively close to home, and I enjoyed being a student here, except for, it's interesting, in both of my pursuing both academic degrees here, I got to a point, midpoint, when I became disillusioned with the institution. And considered dropping out. And even though we were you know, really heavy into the protests and covering a lot of ground, kind of midway I became very disillusioned with what the institution is really about. And the same thing happened in law school. And I was so disillusioned and I was disheartened and seriously considered dropping out in both instances. And I mentioned this because I was surprised when it happened in law school too. You know, I was like, wow, this is the same thing that happened, you know, when I was an undergrad. But I think it was just, you know, coming to grips with the harsh reality of what the institution is about. And in each instance, I made the same decision. I decided that even though I wasn't especially impressed with the institution, because now I had a fuller sense of what it was about, that I would stay and I would leave with whatever they were giving out. That's what I remember thinking. So if they give out bachelor's degrees, then I'll get one. If they're giving out law degrees, I'll get one. And so I'll take what they present to society and I'll use that, but recognize that it's inadequate for my purposes, that the institution should really be doing more. And so that's what happened, and that's how I got here. I kind of got to Madison by default. I couldn't go to Colorado. Plus, like I said, the five-year program was starting here, and it had a different name then.
Yes. What is it? Do you remember?
I don't remember the name, but I'm sure you could find out.
Okay. I know about the five-year program. Mm-hmm. Were there other, apparently there were other African-American students?
Oh, yeah. The five-year program was the vehicle that brought most of the African-American mm-hmm. students here. If you go back and track the population, the student body.
I've done that some.
It really mm-hmm. goes up starting in 66, okay. And then I came in 67. And I mentioned the program because that meant that they were bringing mm-hmm. people here, and so there would be a kind of community mm-hmm. of African American students, which is what it was. We were really a close-knit community.
66 even is kind of early compared to a lot of institutions where they did a lot of they started mm-hmm. they must have had, and that's what I'm not sure about. I was wondering what the tie-in is. I know that during the civil, early 60s, there were a lot of students here that were involved in going south.
So I'm sure that was going on before we came.
Some kind of linkage, mm-hmm. and somewhere along the line, some administrators started recruiting students.
That's right. I think a lot of the credit goes to Ruth Doyle, and I don't know if you're familiar with her.
No, but it would be.
You see, Ruth Doyle is, I think Mrs. Doyle is still alive. She's the widow of Federal Judge James Doyle, and she's the mother of Attorney General James Doyle. She's the former president of the school board. I think she may have even served in the legislature. She's been, mm-hmm. truly been a mover, a shaker, and I think she was a visionary. Mm-hmm. And she decided that the university should have this program and did whatever was necessary to pull it off politically. Mm-hmm. And so Ruth Doyle almost single-handedly was responsible for increasing the number of African American students here. And then ironically, during the student protest movement, we asked her to leave. So we could have an African-American director. Uh-huh. And she put up no resistance and went on to the law school and started doing the same thing. And that's one of the reasons the LEO program is so strong.
Yeah,
so, it took that kind of visionary. But Mrs. Doyle, I believe, is largely, if not entirely, responsible for the numbers beginning to go up in the 60s. She, of course, had her own vision. Mm-hmm. She really wanted people to assimilate.
Oh, yeah.
And, some people didn't want to assimilate.
Nonetheless,
she that was her motivation. Mm-hmm. And so she was responsible. She was responsible for, many of the students living out in the Elm Drive area, which is now not even dorms, where the Friedrich Center is. Mm-hmm. I lived in Elm Drive A. That first building was Elm Drive A. Mm-hmm. The next building was Elm Drive B and C. So a lot of us lived out there, including the athletes. So there wasn't a division. We were really a community.
Huh?
There were some, the flip side of that is, whether or not it was ghettoized.
Maybe the students had a different opinion.
We didn't have a problem with it because we were a close unit in mm-hmm. relative, that doesn't mean everyone got along, mind you. But that's where the greatest concentration was. Now, I was never in the five-year program, ironically. Mm-hmm. I came and talked with her. And, she at that point, the numbers were such that she would meet with each student. Mm-hmm. She would actually recruit them. She would get to know them. And so there was that personal mm-hmm. Interest. And she told me straight up that my grades were too good. And I was a very strong student. And that I shouldn't need the five-year program to make it at Wisconsin.
Okay.
And she also said, which gave me a great deal of peace of mind, that any time that I needed guidance or assistance, mm-hmm. that I should come to her. So it was kind of like having the best of both worlds. She wasn't saying, you're too strong for this program academically and just go out there and fend for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
She said, you are too strong for this program. I'm going to give you some guidance myself. And if you ever need assistance over the years, you can always come back here. So I always felt that I could fall back on the program as a cushion to help me, find my way.
So they all had things like tutoring and other.
Must have. They must have. I never used them, but I just felt that that there was someone who was genuinely interested in me making it. That's what it represented for me, that I could actually, you know, if I really found myself in some major crunch, that I could go back and say, Mrs. Doyle, you know, this is the deal, and where can I go for assistance or what? So, you know, it wasn't this huge, humongous institution to me that I couldn't navigate, because she'd made it clear that she was one of the people who would help me to navigate, even though I wasn't in the program, and that was very touching to me. I relied upon that a great deal.
Do you remember when you first got here, what organizations were around, and did you indeed become involved in the Black Students I'm talking about?
I guess I don't remember the names off the top of my head. Orlando Bell just passed away, and they noted that he was one of the original organizers of the Omega Psi Phi fraternity on campus. I mean, when I came, fraternities were not established. They were just getting started. And so a number of the fraternities are an important social entity. So we didn't have that kind of structure. We had a number of brothers, especially in athletics, and because we were living near each other and we were close, we were, you know, the athletics were important to us. Yeah, we would go out and we would support them, and they'd come to the parties, and there was really no division in that sense. So the athletic presence was very important, especially in the track team. We had a very strong track team at the time, and African Americans in the track team. And Clarence Sherrod eventually came and was on the basketball team, and you know, he's since gone on to being a deputy DA, and now he's the attorney for the school district. So it's that kind of that kind of progression. But I don't remember what the formal organizations were, and Lord knows I was involved in a lot of them.
But the Black Student Alliance is one of them. Seems to be the name that comes up, particularly in the 69 period, where the demands for African American studies and the big protests.
But what I was going to say was, I'm sure that was a title. I haven't registered the title in my mind, primarily because I was really in the movement. So.
Yeah.
Remembering the title, I can call my friends and ask what the title was. But I remember how it all started.
Okay.
You know.
Can we hear
sure. You know, at the time, Wisconsin was one of three main centers in the country where there was activity. There was Columbia on the East Coast, and there was Berkeley on the West Coast, and Madison. And the campuses were seriously active in protests. And with respect to the Black student movement, there was a couple, Libby and Willie Edwards. And I don't know, have you seen or are you familiar with the film The War at Home? Okay, they were interviewed in there.
They were interviewed, yeah, I have that.
Now, Willie and Libby Edwards are responsible for starting the protest movement, the Black student protest movement. I mentioned the other campuses, Columbia and Berkeley, because there were lines of communication between the campuses.
That's what I would like to
And people, know. You know, people would, we'd hear about what the other campuses were considering, and then we'd consider whether or not we wanted to do that. And the Afro-American Studies Department was one example. But you'd hear that they were doing whatever to advance their protest movement, or they had certain things in their list of demands. But Willie and Libby Edwards really announced to the public and to whatever political powers that there was a Black student movement before the students knew. They announced it, and then they came back and said, this is what we've done. And they announced it because of their ties to Columbia or Berkeley. So they came back and told the students, and it was like, you know, either you have to back us or everyone's going to be embarrassed.
they were students.
Yeah, they were grad students, probably. They were a bit older. She was very, very, very light-complected. She could pass for white, blondish hair, but she was African-American. And he was extremely dark. And I mean, they're still alive probably, but that's what I remember. And they came back to Elm Drive, mm-hmm. the campus, and announced that they had announced that there was this movement. And the students were like, oh my God. They literally just dropped it on us.
Oh, yeah.
And because of the civil rights movement.
You remember when that happened?
It probably was in, it was sometime in 67.
That early.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly no later than 68. Uh-huh. I came in 67, 68.
Yeah.
And so and I had gone through the movement. I had my son in 70. And, you know, I'd gone through all this stuff before I had him, so. So it had to be like, you know, late in 68, I would imagine, uh-huh. in the spring of 68. But they laid that on the students.
And what were they, was when they talked about that, the Black, mm-hmm. the Black Student Movement, was that inclusive of need for Afro-American studies?
Of a seed for that.
Okay.
We didn't come up with the notion of a department until we were in negotiations. But yes, there was an interest in having more information.
Classes.
That's right, more classes. And that's where the American Institutions comes in. Because American Institutions had several basic courses called American Institutions. Mm-hmm. And that was a vehicle that the university was using at the time mm-hmm. to invite in guest lectures. For example, Toni Morrison came.
Oh.
During that time, because I remember I attended that lecture, and her lecture was truly phenomenal. You could hear a pin drop, and she gave some excerpts from her writings, and I remember that was my initial exposure to her.
Sure.
And I reminded her of that when she was here a couple of years ago, and she was saying, God, that was before I'd published any major books. We were enthralled. Her presence, her manner, and the fact that she was giving us the words of slaves. And you never heard slaves in a full sense before. You never heard of what slaves thought
mm-hmm.
and what they wrote and what they said. You only heard of what they did, which was either suffer or escape
mm-hmm.
or do both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so they had these American Institutions courses. And they were bringing Toni Morrison and other people in like for a week or two
mm-hmm.
to lecture.
Mm-hmm.
So it was exciting in that regard because you could go check out these different people. But when we started, I'm going to take a leap from when Willie and Libby introduced this to the Afro-American Studies Department for a minute. But one of the offshoots, I guess,
mm-hmm.
of the protest movement was to push for more classes and more information and more knowledge on African-Americans. And there was a committee, I think, that was formed. I think Professor Hayward, who has since left the university and actually left, ironically, amidst sexual harassment charges a couple of years ago, which I processed through my office and then they were processed through some other offices. At any rate, Professor Hayward, Fred Hayward, was the chair of that committee. And
I think he was in the Holly community.
In the what?
In the Holly. He might have been later.
I'm sure he was. He's... Aside from the sexual harassment charges against him, he's always been very
mm-hmm.
earnest.
Mm-hmm.
He's been an earnest supporter in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And, the university had put together a committee for this issue, and it was one of the various things that were offshoots of our demands. And
it was the Afro-American Studies Steering Committee or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. And we would meet in humanities.
Mm-hmm. Were you on that committee?
Either I was on that committee or I was a spokesperson for the students. What I was going to say was, as our movement evolved, you know, different people had different roles,
mm-hmm.
and I was one of the major spokespersons. So when there was something to be said on behalf of the group,
mm-hmm.
then I was one of the major people to do that. So I was playing that role
mm-hmm.
on this committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember us walking down Bascom to go to Humanities to one of the meetings. And before that meeting, the university had been talking about increasing the amount of African-American focus in these American Institutions classes.
Mm-hmm.
And as we walked down to Bascom for that, down Bascom to Humanities for that particular meeting, someone in our group said, we should go for a department. And again, it was with, you know, kind of like the Columbia-Berkeley connection, mm-hmm. you know. That's what's happening in different campuses. So we should want a full-fledged department. We should want a chair. We should want tenured, mm-hmm. tenured faculty. And mm-hmm. we're having this discussion going down Baskin, right?
As you're going to a meeting.
Where they, you know, where they're on a different track. Yeah. And I remember so well, I told Professor Hayward that later. I remember so well, you know, we went in, you know, so they told me that's what they wanted. So that's what I said.
Okay, you don't know when this meeting was.
No, it was one of the meetings, and you know, I'm sure if there are 68. Minutes from the meeting, okay. from the committee meeting, this may have actually been 68, 69, I don't know. But so we decided to send the way down. We get to the meeting. I'm sitting at the table, and, you know, other people are sitting at the table, and Hayward is sitting across from me, and other, you know, professors are sitting there. And, you know, I said, well, we've decided that instead of focusing, having an African-American focus in these American institutions courses, we've decided that we want the university to establish a full-fledged Afro-American Studies department. The looks on their faces. I remember the looks. It was like,
they probably blew them away, like, because they were talking about a couple of classes, maybe.
That's right. God, the looks on their faces. I remember it. I remember Hayward especially, because this had not been, as I recalled it, it had not been an acrimonious committee. Uh-huh. So, you know, we actually had a number of professors that were sympathizers, you know, and so then they were in this difficult position, like, how can you ask us to go back and ask the university? I mean, the looks on their faces were like, what are these students asking for? And, you know, I just said, I laid out our rationale, and, you know, we talked about a history of people going mm-hmm. back, you know, infinitely almost, mm-hmm. and how, you know, there was hardly anything at the university, and the university had resources, and that's what they should do.
And so, but that you did, I mean, that rationale and everything you developed on the spot, or mm-hmm. as you were going down the...
That's right, because I had no time. I mean, yeah. we literally came up with, because I remember that so distinctly. We were walking down Bascom, wow. and I don't even remember who said it, but it was like, that's what we should go for. You know, these courses are piddly. We shouldn't mm-hmm. be going for yeah. these courses. Mm-hmm. We should go for a department. And the university was actually responsive in a timely manner, because, you know, when you check whenever the department was established, it was shortly after that.
It was shortly after that, but it did come up after that big blowout where the National Guard came in.
Sure.
And
still.
Okay, but I'm just saying mm-hmm. that also. And
I mean, in terms of how the university does things, it was established within 2 years of that.
It was very
which
fast.
Is significant.
It was very.
You know, and
part of my argument is one of the reasons why that was successful, where the other groups not, was that. It happened in that time period.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because I was saying that, you know, these are offshoots. A friend of mine, John Felder, mm-hmm. was another spokesperson for the group. And he's actually in the movie, The War at Time. They have the footage of him giving the formal demands.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so the Afro-American Studies Department was one offshoot. The Afro-American Center... and getting it together was another offshoot. Increasing the number of African-American students was another focus. And like I said, we asked Ruth Doyle to leave the directorship of the program she started. And Jim Baugh came in at that time, James Baugh, B-A-U-G-H. Mm-hmm. He had been the assistant director. And you know, Ruth, I was always impressed with how she never gave us any flack about that. She never questioned it. It was like, that's what you want to do, fine. And, you know, and in the scheme of things, she didn't really need that program. I mean, she gave it her love, and she developed it and nurtured it. But she didn't need to stay there. I told you about all the stuff she was involved in. Yeah. She could just go on to the next thing.
Well, but also, I think, and I do want to touch on this, because you mentioned her philosophy was more assimilationist. Mm-hmm. But that period of time was very nationalist, mm-hmm. especially for students.
That's right, and she recognized that.
Uh-huh. And I wondered, what were your feelings about that? And the whole question, it seems like the identity question is very significant mm-hmm. in student movements, starting with '66, the Black Power movement, and the whole question of identity. and this question of larger question of nationalism.
So you're asking me what I thought about that?
Well, what did you come involved in that? Was that your, at the time, you personally, or do you feel that that also was other students gravitated towards that type of philosophy or ideology, rather, I should say?
Well, you know, we had a variety of ideas, mm-hmm. you know, that existed, and I told you about how it started. So, and had we had it started from some kind of meeting, and people trying to figure this out, I don't know if it ever would have gotten off the ground. I mean, it started because they dropped it on us, you know, because William Libby dropped it on us. But so we had, you know, we had the full array of people, who were very nationalistic, mm-hmm. and people who were more assimilation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you indicated, there are a couple of things happening that were really driving the momentum. There was the Vietnam War protest movement, mm-hmm. which was happening simultaneously. And, it caused us to have some cross bonds on campus because we knew their leaders, they knew our leaders, and we kept in touch. And whenever we were shooting for having the strongest protest marches or for boycotting classes in the strongest way, we would connect mm-hmm. and reinforce each other.
Okay.
And we had lots of people come, like Louis Farrakhan came to campus a number of times, and, mm-hmm. the general community didn't know who he was. He didn't have anywhere near the notoriety he has now. Mm-hmm. He would come to Afro-America Center, he would sit down and talk with us. Mm-hmm. Nina Simone came, Bill Cosby came, we had a black homecoming queen, we had a court with four African Americans in an homecoming court. There was a push to improve things mm-hmm. in every regard that we could, and to push the university to do that. I was a spokesperson in many of the meetings we had with the chancellor. We wanted a full-time director of the Afro-American Center. And there had been several part-time directors or temporary directors. Mm-hmm. Gene Parks was even a temporary director. Okay. And we wanted a full director, so they had a committee dealing with the director of the Afro-American Study, the Afro-American Center. And the number one person turned down the position, and Kwame Salter was number two. Okay. Sam Salter at the time. I don't know that he changed his name to Kwame. Anyway, he was number two, and he was at Whitewater, and the university didn't want him, despite the fact that he was the next person on the list. Mm-hmm. And that proved to be a very decisive and divisive matter for our movement, mm-hmm. because we had hung together very well for all kinds of things, and there were part of us who felt, well, the university didn't want Kwame, so they were going to throw out the whole search and start all over. Mm-hmm. And they were doing this, of course, in the summer, so students wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. And there were a whole group of us who felt that we weren't necessarily Kwame supporters, but we needed a director for the center, and if he was good enough to be number two, then we should bring him in.
Sure.
And then there was another group that didn't care for him, and said that we had fought long and hard for director of the center to have a certain kind of director of the center, and for a variety of reasons they were not interested in having him. He was not, so they felt that we should hold out and go for someone else. And it became a matter of pragmatism. And the part of the group that went out was the part that wanted to have a permanent director there at that time, no matter what, because it felt that the university would really gain momentum in opposition, and we never would get mm-hmm. a permanent director. Mm-hmm. I was a spokesperson for the group when we took over the chancellor's office and told him that we were putting Kwame in, that we were going to use the center regularly, that we were going to man the center 24 hours a day, and then if the university disagreed with that, it was going to literally have to come in and take us out and throw us out. Mm-hmm. So that's how Kwame came into the center.
Now, when did this happen? Do you remember? Was that after the Afro-Americans? That was afterwards.
It may have been, in my mind, they're all simultaneous.
Sure, I mean, so I think they were close to there.
Yeah, so. I don't remember the exact date. I think is something that you could check easily.
I have some of those informations, yeah. I just got to reread it.
But. The university was doing this either in the summer of 68 or the summer of 67. One or the other.
I was just wondering, the center was already established by the time you went for Afro American Studies?
The center was established when we came.
Okay.
I mean, before we came, it was here. It had been here, I don't know, a year or so. But it was part-time, it was small, meager budget. It was not an institution of significance for the students, you know.
What was the relationship between that, or how did you envision the relationship between the center and Afro-American Studies? They complemented each other, or was there?
I think, philosophically, yes, but it wasn't a major. I mean, we didn't think of them as being linked together, that they would do anything together necessarily. So they were just two separate demands.
The center was primarily cultural kinds of things.
Cultural and educational. It was, before the center. In Memorial Union in the Rathskeller, in the center area of the Rathskeller, when you go in and then the cafeteria is to your right. Mm-hmm. But in that area, that main center area at the Rathskeller, right to the right, there's a little condiment table inside to the right. That used to be what was called the Colored Corner. And before the center developed, there were tables there, and that was the place you could go on campus to find out about any African American. If you wanted to know where Donna Jones was, you'd go there and you'd ask.
Oh, okay.
So that was our community, that was our cultural center, that was our social center right there. And people would go through if you wanted directions, if you wanted to find, wanted to find you.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't find anyone. You
that
just
was your
go.
Space.
That's
you,
that
you
was. It was that corner, and I'm told that corner had been there ever since Lorraine Hansberry had been here, who wrote *Raisin in the Sun*. So, that was the center. I mean, that was, and we were interested in having a real center, not a corner.
Yeah.
So we kept pressing that the center should become viable. Because students wanted to be able to associate with students like themselves as well as others, we were very much into wanting to develop community projects and community activities. Mm-hmm. So we had to get to know the community, and we need a base from which to operate. Mm-hmm. That was what that was all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it was the summer of 68 or the summer of 69. That's how Kwame came in, that's how permanent director was set up, and that's how it was until the university moved for a multicultural center and watered it down.
Well, but the, wasn't the center burnt down?
Yeah, but that was just a building, that wasn't an institution.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it had been on University Avenue where the business school is now, and one of those, there were some old houses there.
But the center was still functioning at the time that it happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was. And it didn't stop functioning. They just moved us to a different building.
Okay.
We lost, we didn't lose major valuables because we didn't have any. But there had been complaints, from the students about the fact that it was too small and it was in this old building.
Mm-hmm.
And the fire was mysterious.
Yes, it
was.
So, mysterious, yeah.
So, one day we woke up and the center wasn't there anymore. And the university dutifully and hastily
I thought
found
they had closed
a different
the center
location.
Down, and it wasn't until the mid-80s, late 80s, before they started a multicultural center. The center had stopped functioning for a while.
Well, they did close the center down, but it was amidst the political strife was that the university wanted the center to become a multicultural center. Because it didn't want to give Hispanics their own center, and it didn't want to give all these groups their center.
So that probably
the center didn't just close.
That happened later on in the mid-70s.
Which part?
The fact that the center, the
university started pressuring.
Yeah,
because I had my daughter in 73, and that strife was going on then.
Yeah,
because I couldn't be
that's
as involved directly.
Started getting.
giving pressure to the university, and the university decided that it wasn't going to have all these different centers, and it kept trying to get Kwame and the Afro-American Center to yield and become a multicultural center. And they were resisting that because they felt that each group should have their own center. So the university prevailed. Mm-hmm. It got rid of the center, then let it cool off for a while, and then created the Central Multicultural Center.
After there was demands for that too.
Probably. I wasn't involved in that part, so I'm not knowledgeable.
There's a couple of other things that I wanted to touch on that, that you've touched on. One is the relationship with white students.
Mm-hmm.
And if I understand, there probably wasn't too many other minority students at that time.
No, not a whole lot.
But any, the relationship between black students and white students, because I know sometimes, in some campuses, there was a part of contention, even though the groups, the white student groups might have been leftist or progressive students and involved in Vietnam and all that. It seemed like the focus of minority students, and particularly African-American students, was quite different in some respects than the white student movement.
Well, I recall that in general it was compatible. Mm-hmm. I mean, the leadership in both movements recognized that we were in a unique time in history, and that we were in a unique position to gain more from assisting each other, or certainly to gain more from not being in conflict. So it's not that we were buddy-buddy, but we knew each other, and we weren't necessarily included in each other's strategy sessions, but we would be informed of each other's, you know, anticipated movements for the most part. When did you come here, Steve?
I didn't get here till 85.
Okay. By 85, the whole atmosphere on campus had changed. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin is... didn't want these cosmopolitan people coming from all over the country. See, when we were here in the late 60s and early 70s, I think people got along relatively well between the races because they came from cities where they knew of people of color. I mean, there were, you know, lots of people from New York and from Boston and from Chicago and from L.A. Mm-hmm. And so an African-American wasn't a foreign entity to them. Not that they necessarily embraced us, and not that there wasn't racism, but there was a greater receptivity, and there was a greater alliance, which then caused us to be able to, you know, we benefited from that with these movements, and political.
You weren't confronted with a lot. Well, there was less white students who here that they didn't have the experience.
That's right. Who weren't exposed. Yeah. But see, at the time, same time, the university was bringing students from different cosmopolitan centers across the country, and so the African American students were coming from across the country. Mm-hmm. You know, Orlando came from Alabama. I came from Chicago. There are people here from New York. People from California. The athletes were coming from all over. Mm-hmm. So there really was there was a mixing, and there was a cosmopolitan air, which also, I really appreciated.
But also Wisconsin probably attracted a lot of progressive students because of its reputation.
No doubt. And so we were all able maximize, that's not right. We benefited from that combination and the political powers in the Capitol. And the chancellor made sure that that would never happen again. And they began to limit the number of students that could come from other states. And they began to increase the number of Wisconsin students, hence the kind of ignorance that made it necessary for the Holly Committee and the Holly Report. Mm-hmm. It was a much greater cosmopolitan. It was at that time, it was, you know, I've never I've actually never been to Berkeley, and I've never been to Columbia in terms of their academic settings, but in terms of their reputations, Wisconsin was par. Uh-huh. Madison was par.
More of that type of
yeah. Okay. And we benefited from that. In fact, the most successful student protest movement was one that we led.
Yes, that's right.
And the others supported. One of our black student protest movement, you know, the university would die before it would close down, but there probably were no more than 400 students in class in that one particular day. I mean, it was...
The one in 69 when you...
Yeah, it was just... Yeah. It was so successful, you know.
But they called in the National Guard to...
Yeah, they called in the National Guard.
So how was that like?
It was scary. It was scary. You know, a number of people got their heads bashed in. Some people had to leave school. Some people were hurt physically. You know, see, also, you know, I'm from Chicago, where police brutality is just, it's significant and it's a part of life.
Sure. You see.
And what struck me in terms of this has to do with, race, it has to do with small town, big city, but during the beginning of the protest movements, especially the white protesters, would go down State Street breaking all these windows, you know, and the store windows, and they weren't getting beat up for it. You know, I was like, wow, what kind of world is this? I mean, you know, because where I'm from, Chicago, they knock you out just as soon as kill you. But they, you know, went down State Street for some time, breaking out windows, and the merchants would put the windows back in, and then they'd go and they'd break them out during the protest movement. The merchants would put the windows back in, and this was before the guard was brought in. Mm-hmm. And then the merchants got hip and stopped putting the windows back in and would just put up boarded, just put up the boarded wooden boards. And then it grew to a point where, you know, the movements were so persistent that they called in the guards, and then they had more, they started beating them up. Mm. But it took a while, and I was like, whoa, this is so foreign. Mm. This is so foreign to me that these dudes, you know, could go down State Street and not get beat up, and they were mostly white.
Yeah.
But it took a while, but eventually it got to the level of kind of urban response, where they started beating them up, and then they stopped doing it as much. But we had lots of candlelight vigils and candlelight marches, a lot of strategically placed things. And I, you know, I feel very proud of what we accomplished in the Afro-American Studies Department. It's one of the finest ones in the country. They had a huge, you know, they hosted one of the national conferences here just a couple of years ago, and largely due to Professor Nellie McKay and her reputation and people coming, I've always felt that was one of the finest things that we spawned the years that the center was going strong, and even now the Multicultural Center, I consider that something that we started, we pushed for. The 5-year program, I don't know if we can take much credit for that. It's just kind of evolved over the years, and the number of students hasn't grown. You know, the university still has difficulty attracting undergraduates.
Yeah. I look at, in fact, the numbers in 68 when there was 400.
I think we have more.
The ratio was better than it is now.
Yeah, and the students, and that's remarkable, sad. It's remarkably sad, I guess I should say, because none of us thought that the numbers were ever be smaller. In fact, when we came, and the university would boast of having 1,000 1,000 black students, we complained that we thought most of those were Africans from Africa, and that they, in fact, did not have 1,000 black students, as we would acknowledge. Yeah. But the African community, the African student community, was also, you know, significant and was also supportive, particularly socially. We went to lots of parties that African students had, and they would come to our parties and stuff.
There's another important question I would like to touch on, is how do you perceive, maybe, I'm not exactly sure how to word this, but the fact that you're an African-American woman, and indeed Well, let me put it this way. The readings and the media and everything, you look back, you see, usually, and it doesn't matter what movement it is, mm-hmm. the Chicano movement, African American movement, but you see the leaders being, or the media always gravitating to the males as leadership roles. Mm-hmm. And I know from experience
that
a lot of women were involved, and they were leading the group. And I'm just wondering if indeed did that, you know, what is
was
your perception?
Was it sexist?
Well, it's not only, it's just that I kind of want to get to...
How we work together.
Yeah. And what was the role of women in,
sure.
in the movement?
I'm going to digress for a second because I'm thinking you'd ask me about a date. I think the meeting with the chancellor about the Afro-American Center and when we declared that we were putting Kwame in and we were taking over, I think that happened in the fall of 1970.
Oh, okay.
Because I recall us having a strategy meeting the night before in Celery Hall, and I was a house fellow in Celery then, so it would have been logical.
Okay.
But I don't know, are you talking to Billy Harris during the course of this? Do you know who he is?
The
Equal Rights Division?
That name has come up to me a couple of times, and I haven't got a hold of him, but
okay,
I did find
you should. You should, because Billy was at that strategy meeting.
Division?
Yeah, he's a state employee, so okay. He'll be easy to get. He'll be listed as Bill Harris.
Okay.
You can say I referred you.
Okay.
He's also been very active in the African American Alumni Association.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Billy, I remember Billy and I being at the meeting and other people. It was a small strategy meeting. And Billy's a superb strategist. And has an uncanny way sometimes of predicting things. And we had gone over this conversation that we were going to have with the chancellor. We anticipated questions, we anticipated resistance. And, you know, we were all doing this to prepare for the meeting, and so, you know, to help me also as a spokesperson. And I remember us laughing after we left the meeting and went over to take over the center, that Billy had been on point on so many things that the chancellor was saying. And mind you, the chancellor's office was revamped after that meeting.
Oh.
They have a secret, they don't have a
yeah.
secret, they have a private stairwell that goes up and down so the chancellor can go out and go out.
When we went there, that's how she got away.
But see, that's there because of our stuff.
Okay.
They built that in because the chancellor couldn't leave. But anyway, in terms of our roles, you know, I'm a feminist, and that's probably not news to you or to a number of other people. But and I think I've always been and will always be. But there is, you know, a fair amount of sexism in the movement. I didn't, you know, it's not a matter of whether or not sexism is present, it's a matter of whether or not it's an obstacle.
Okay.
And I didn't see it as an obstacle. I mean, with Willie and Libby, they presented it to us together. And then because of their relationship, you know, they were married, I think because of their relationship, then they divvied up responsibilities between themselves in terms of leadership. Willie then became the leader of the group, and it was kind of, Libby was his right-hand person.
Okay.
I'm sure it's sexist, but that's the way it turned out, you know. And then we had another leader that succeeded Willie, because Willie's style wasn't as accommodating for the whole group. He just didn't have the most expansive and appropriate leadership style. And I don't remember now what the shortcomings were, but Kenny Williams became the next leader of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very fine leadership style. And, you know, I don't know, we never talked about having a woman as a leader of the group, but we never talked about Kenny leading the group because he was a man. It was Kenny leading the group because of the kind of personality he had.
Mm-hmm.
And he was evolving into a pretty fine leader. And what should we do at this point? And then Kenny became the leader. There was another couple that was very instrumental at the time. There was a brother named Kuelewa, whose last name I can't remember. And he married a sister named Joanne, because, you know, a lot of unions were occurring here, you know, at the time. People came and they didn't know each other and they were connecting. So Kualoa and Joanne met here and married. And Kualoa became a very strong leader, and he was a very strong nationalist. And he's an African-American brother who had changed his name, just like Kwame had changed his name. And he was one of the people we lost in the movement when we decided to go for Kwame. Because he was one of the strongest people who felt that we were, you know, we've worked this hard, we've had these protests, we've pushed this and this, and this is the kind of leader that we've always said we wanted for the center, and Kwame is not that kind of leader, and I don't want him over here in the group. He was outnumbered. Okay. The group said, you know, that's fine and good, but we're at the point where we need a full-time leader, or else we're going to lose this center. And that was after the fire. I think the fire had just occurred in the earlier semester, so that was another concern. Like, we have a new building now, but we just can't let this, you know, we just can't let this slide. And in terms of spokesperson, you know, John Felder and I were the two main spokespersons, so we had a male and a female spokesperson. And I don't remember how
it wasn't,
that...
It wasn't like that was planned.
Yeah, it wasn't like a sexual division that I recalled. You know, I'm fortunate to be fairly articulate, and I'm very earnest. I believe in these things, and you know, I had no problem. I wasn't afraid to be the spokesperson. I wasn't afraid to go to the chancellor's office and tell them what the group felt, because I knew that the group, that I was truly speaking for the group. And I never have my own hidden agenda. I think that's what really gets some people in trouble that are trying to be leaders, when they have their hidden agenda and the group thinks they have X and then they come out with Y, which is their own thing. That's just not fair. That's not leadership. That's not fine leadership. That's right. Absolutely.
Tell me, when you took over the chancellor's office, how long did that last? And how did that get resolved?
Well, it was a meeting. We took it over in the sense that he couldn't leave until we retired.
But it's a takeover.
Yeah, that's true. We can't.
For him, I'm sure he was very conscious.
I don't know. I suppose it took an hour or so. Yeah. However, like, we stuffed the room. You know, we brought enough students to stuff the room. And, you know, I was the spokesperson. And we met for as long as was necessary to tell them what we were doing. Simultaneously, we had another group already staked out at the center so that they couldn't go and close the center at that point. We had really, you know, we really had our strategy together.
And
we had a number of students already using the center. We had talked to Kwame. He agreed to go with this. And he said, if you all can do it, I don't have any problem with it. My daughter's father, who I wasn't dealing with at the time, but he became the bookkeeper accountant for the center, and he and Kwame met and became good friends. He was a journalism grad student. We wanted the center to function, to be a functional unit, so that students could take advantage of it, so that the students could leave the colored corner, which was nice, but it was not, you know.
I mean, that you can have.
It was just a corner.
Just a corner. Well, that you can have any time you wanted to go eat.
That's right. That's right. We had outgrown the corner, basically, is what it amounted to. And so I really don't recall. I'm sure the short answer to your question is it took long enough. It took as long as we needed, and it was too long for the chancellor.
did it get resolved in the way that you? Most of the points that you asked for?
You know, I just don't remember how it ended, because we were telling him. So I don't think we were asking him for anything. We were literally telling him. We were putting him on notice that when we leave here, we're going over to the center, and African-American students are going to be in the center, and Kwame's going to be the director, so you need to pay him. You're going to need an accountant. You're going to need a so-and-so. You're going to need a so-and-so. So just get ready that this is going to be a functional operation until such time that you kick us out. And we kind of had a standoff. We went, we took over the center. I don't recall how long it went until we decided that it was okay. You know, probably the chancellor talked to Kwame, or somehow we got the sign, the signal, that they weren't going to come down on us and that we could function.
And
we breathed a sigh of relief, and we had a whole, you know, slew of people. And they began to function. You know, Orlando was a PR director at some point in time. A sister named Charlotte Wilhoit, who since passed away, I think she was the first cultural director. Like I said, my daughter's father, Anthony Bristow, was the bookkeeper, accountant, whatever mm-hmm. the term is. Mm-hmm. Kwame was the director. And we were about the business of being a decent place for African-American students to come so that they could have a small part on campus that was a home away from mm-hmm. home. Yeah. It's not, you know, and I know I don't have to explain this to you, but it, I was going to say it's not really unlike what Ruth Doyle presented to me when she said, no, you can't be in the program, but you have a place to come if you have academic trouble, if you have a question mm-hmm. about how to deal with financial aid, if you need to know how to maneuver the university, you can come here. Okay. And the center was to serve a similar purpose for us.
Getting back to Afro-American studies, though.
Okay.
It seems that, you know, you want to struggle, and indeed it was something probably that the university, as opposed to maybe a lot of the white student demands about Vietnam or just mm-hmm. deinvest, you know, and don't do this research or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's something that they could say, okay, we can do this.
That's right, they could do it.
We can, you know, provide an academic, you know, component mm-hmm. here because that's what we're about. Mm-hmm. But where, how long did the student role continue? Because it doesn't seem like, if you recall, were the students very much involved in getting the professors and the director for this for the
I don't program. Recall that we were I recall, and Frieda may have a better sense of that. See, Frieda wasn't here when this started.
No, she told me that.
And she came in and she was in a unique position to be interested
she was in
the department.
Yeah.
She was in a grad student, but because of as an artist and a historian. Uh-huh. And so I think they had another group that dealt with that. I mean, we were political. I mean, we checked it out. We, mm-hmm. you know, we checked out who was going to be the director, mm-hmm. Who was going to be the chair.
Because like other campuses, the students demanded, well, we will choose the director. You know, we will do all this, and that's yeah. what it seems like that they usually do.
Yeah, that. I don't recall us being involved to that extent. Mm-hmm. I wasn't. Okay. I don't recall being involved to that extent. Although. We were always mindful of it. We weren't ignoring it. I'm trying to remember, there was a brother here who has since retired, a real fine gentleman, who had been a professor in meteorology. I think he came in as the first chair.
Okay.
And he was real decent. So he was fine, mm-hmm. you know, for us as the first chair. Okay. They were going to call on someone from campus. Then there was another chair that came in who was a little more controversial, whose name I can't remember. He came from outside. And then they had a kind of a rotation of some people from this campus, and then eventually they brought people from elsewhere. But, you know, I think what, I don't recall what struck us as a group. What struck me was that it was definitely a department, mm-hmm. that it was going to have a full budget, that it was going to have tenured faculty, and that it was going to grow and offer classes that were viable. Mm-hmm. So, okay. you know.
One of the names that comes up about that, because I've talked to also Craig Warner and some other couple of other people, mm-hmm. is David Cronin, mm-hmm. who was the dean of LMS, who was supposedly okay. a very powerful dean, that said that, and he did himself had that book on Marcus Garvey. That,
okay.
So apparently he
made
had a lot
it happen.
To do with, yeah, he
sure.
was supportive of a department. If you were okay. going to have a department, you were going to have a full-fledged department.
Okay, well then we lucked out. And see, I wasn't yeah. aware of that dimension. So if that's part of why it happened, so be it.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah, and it's,
then
and
it
it's,
just meant we had a dean
sounds,
who wasn't removed.
And it's kind of odd. It's kind of an odd combination, kind of like this woman,
yeah.
Ruth. Because
Doyle.
It didn't seem
it's
like
Ruth.
The type, you know, that mm-hmm. I heard about this. So it sounded like that.
And it's, you know, it's kind of like an insider-outsider. Mm-hmm. You know, I think some of this, you make the great, and from my experience, you make the greatest progress when you have a very good relationship inside and outside. If I'm an inside administrator, there's only so many things I can say. You really need mm-hmm. an external push mm-hmm. from a group or something.
And
so maybe he was a silent, quiet insider behind the scenes that I didn't know about.
That's something that it seems to me that it really happened when we were doing the Minority Coalition thing, because
okay.
Donna Shalala came soon after that. And she
mm-hmm.
said very similar things. Well, you know, you guys keep us, you know, because if
that's
I
right.
have this, mm-hmm. it'll happen. And that's something that seems that doesn't really come out a lot in the stories, that there are people in the inside that are favorable to some of the things that our students are talking about.
I mean, that's what Ruth Doyle did. I didn't know about Cronin, but then that answers one of my questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't worrying about it. I knew it happened. I knew it happened at a reasonable pace, that it wasn't being slowed down. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pleased to know that that's because there was a dean who was receptive.
Tell me if another topic that I want to discuss, because it seems to be something that recurs in not only in the literature, but you know, in conversations too, is this racism. Was that a factor, or was that something that we're able to gravitate as far as an issue, a symbolic issue? I know that sometimes that the students use that as a motivating tool.
You know, it was real. I remember we lost a brother who was a real nice brother. There wasn't as much interracial dating then in terms of African-American men and white women. Mm-hmm. Because, everyone, this was new. I mean, the numbers were new, that we had so many folks and everything, and then we had all the protest movement. Mm-hmm. But eventually, some brothers started, checking out and dealing with white women. And there was a brother, I don't remember his name, and it would be in the paper, you could do a newspaper search. A fairly nice brother, kind of dark skin, large build. I don't think he was an athlete, but had, almost a football player's build. And he started checking out some white woman who lived, I think, in the towers. This is across from the Nitty Gritty, the tall building there. Her father came and blew him away. Yeah. On campus one night. I think it was after he had gone out with his daughter. And that was just real. I mean, that was only about race. And it was very riveting. And it happened amidst this. And the father, if I'm not mistaken, made no bones about, why he did. Now, this young man had not done anything. It's not like they got in an argument or anything. Yeah. He found this young man and killed him because he was black, dealing with his daughter. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there were some other things. There was a lot in...
What about the students, black students?
In response to that?
Yeah.
Well, I'd have to go back and check the timing. I mean, we were distressed. And we commented, but I don't recall if anything special was done. I think there was so much shock that it was so blatant. Mm-hmm. And it was also considered, amongst the students, a warning for African-American men. Mm-hmm. That, we're amidst these protest movements and we're trying to do all this and that. And if you all venture out in that way, you're in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And you need to understand, and you'd have to go back and look in the papers.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
I
have some clippings in there.
It was really, and then beyond that, like I said, many of us lived together, and there wasn't a hassle. I'm overlooking the major example. Mm-hmm. major example. I mentioned I had my son in 1970. Mm-hmm. I lived in the dorms 1.5 years. And then when I was pregnant, I moved into an apartment. And the university, amidst all of our demands and this all this the atmosphere that we had in terms of protests and progress, was also trying to increase this number of house fellows that were African American. And so I applied for and it was accepted as a house fellow, so that when I returned from school, returned from having my son, I came back as a house fellow in 1971, and my son was born in the summer of 70. So I was a house fellow in Celery, and Celery has 9 floors of men and 9 floors of women, or at least at that time it did. So that's 18 house fellows. And 4 of the 18 were African American, 3 women and 1 man. And as a continuation of what we were doing,
you know, campus-wide, the four of us decided that we would have like a support group for the African-American students that lived in Celery. And we would meet periodically. Mm-hmm. You know, they could use us as mentors. This is in addition to our what we're doing as house fellows in our individual floors, where we had, what, 30 to 60 students. Mm-hmm. And so we decided that we would do this. We created, you know, we took this initiative. And I forget, we had a name for the group. I don't remember what it was. But, it, you know, it was kind of another way for African-American students to feel more comfortable. Sure. And we could assist them academically. And so it was very successful in that year. And the students were very grateful. The next year, I was the only African-American house fellow in Celery, in 71, 72. Mm-hmm. And the residence halls has a practice where students, once you're there in the first year, you can request where you go the next year. Mm-hmm. And they'll try to honor your request in terms of where you want to live. And so the sisters did that. And many of them wanted to live on my floor, which, guess what, gave us a higher concentration of African-American women on my floor. I think I lived in the 8th floor Celery. And Lord, all hell broke loose.
Oh, really? What happened?
You named the stereotype, it emerged. You named the rumor, it was out. I mean, the rumors were that that people were raped on our floor, that there was all this drug use on our floor, that there were all these wild parties on our floor, that there was this flagrant sex on our floor. And it got so bad that people would come up to the 8th floor and get off the elevator and stand and look around. And then be stunned because it looked like any other dorm floor. I remember we had one. Well, it started with the fact that I wouldn't stop these young women from moving on my floor. Mm-hmm. So I started getting all these calls from people saying, well, you're not going to let them do that, are you? And I was like, pardon me? They're like, well, there are all these five-year students who are living, I mean, and you're not going to let them do that, are you? You're going to make them live, you know, all over the campus, aren't you? I said, it's their right. Why would I?
You were getting calls just from other students? Or?
I was getting calls from students and administrators. Jim Ball called me at one point. He was the director now of the African American, of the five-year program, because we insisted that they get an African American director. And he's calling me to lean on me to not have these kids moving us forward. And I was like, excuse me? And then he started laying all this stuff on about their grades. And so the presumption was that they weren't going to function well as students if they lived together. Which ironically is the opposite presumption that existed when we lived in Elm Drive, and we did just fine, thank you. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't exclusively African American, but there was a greater concentration. Sure. So that we had a community, and that's all we were doing. You know, when there were four house fellows, we created an additional community comfort for them. And of course, as the only African American house fellow there, you know, I would do the same.
Sure.
But I received lots of pressure, and like I said, there were all these stereotypes and all these rumors, and it was campus-wide. So we became known as the ghetto. And there was all this talk campus-wide about the ghetto in Celery on the 8th floor. And, you know, it was hard on everyone on the floor. It was hard on the white students who, you know, had never been discriminated against before, and who are now being discriminated against because they were living with all these sisters. It was hard on the sisters because of those people who presumed that it was an automatic negative for them to live together. I remember we had one white female student who was considered a bitch, quote unquote, just her manner. She had grown up in money, was accustomed to a certain type of treatment, and, you know, thought she was hot stuff. Mm-hmm. And her parents called me up one morning just furious. You know, wanting to take her from that floor. They had called the chancellor, you know. I can't remember who called me first. Was it her, the chancellor's office, somebody, you know. And they just heard that their daughter was living in this horrible place, and she probably had lied about the place. And, you know, they wanted to take her, and I don't know. And I said, fine, take her.
Because I knew that she was a bitch anyway, so take her, make my life a bit easier. And I remember it was so ironic because she moved, and the next week her new house fellow called me and said, why is this bitch on my floor? And she was a white female too. I said, well, she was dissatisfied, and that woman was like, what? You're like, this is not an improvement for my floor. And I said, I know, but, you know, I'm sorry. I can't. Because that woman had shown out.
Someplace else, huh?
She had shown out. She hadn't even been there a week, and she had shown out. And this woman was like, I don't want no problems on my floor. I said, well, you know, her mother called, the chancellor called, so-and-so called, you know. What can I say? They wanted to move her, and I thought it was quite fine. And I'm sorry that it's now dumped on you. I think we might have had... I think we had one fight on our floor that was interracial. And I want to say it was related to that young woman, but somebody who had a similar attitude and problem. The reality was people on the floor got along fine. There wasn't a lot of racial strife, and no more than there would have been in any other situation. The African-Americans women were permitted to live on the floor, just like, you know, it was their right, and I felt that I should acknowledge that, and I was not about to feed into any stereotypes about too many African Americans being together as an automatic negative. I became frustrated enough that I became frustrated enough that I went up to Bascom Hall to protest the manner in which we were being perceived, and talked within the director of, well, I guess he was the dean of students. Oh, God, I could see.
Ginsburg?
Yes. Ginsburg. Yes. I went and met with Paul Ginsburg and said that I knew he'd heard these rumors because they were all over the place. And I wanted him to know that that was not the reality, and that it was causing an unfair burden for my floor and the students, because they were there to be students primarily, and I was there to assist them in their residential life. And all this other stuff was a complete hassle. And that I wanted him to pass it on to the chancellor, and I wanted them to stop or block any of that negativity when they heard of it. So I don't know if it in fact changed anything, but I went on record, and I also went back and I met with my floor. We met lots of times during this because the pressure was so heavy. I mean, it was so negative externally.
Sure.
And we met, you know, the women on my floor met as much as often as we thought it was necessary to fortify us as a group so that there wouldn't be any splits within the group.
But it wasn't. So you're talking about the whole floor. It wasn't just African American women.
No, the whole floor was subjected to it. I mean, so it was because of the concentration of African American women. But the whole floor. I mean, you know, white women that lived on that floor. If they went out and said, you know, well, where do you live? And said on the 8th floor cellar. Oh, wow. So you know, the whole floor was subjected to it. It was a gross, negative stereotype.
But you were still a student, weren't you?
That's right. I was a senior. Wow. Well, I was at that time.
So a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. I was a senior, and I was pissed. I graduated in January, so I had this one semester where this was going on, and I wanted to do what I could to, you know, protect the women on my floor from this, you know, gross injustice, basically.
That kind of leads me into the next point is when you did graduate, and the fact that you graduated, what did you do? And I guess what I really want to, I know that you went to law school in the mid-70s, and you're kind of in a unique position of being here as part, you know, as part of the university now in a working position. And you probably maybe can see some of that legacy of the 60s as a student.
Mm-hmm.
And have things improved, and where we're at now is
sure.
you know, that kind of thing, retrospective kind of thing.
Well, as the director of the Office of Affirmative Action and Compliance, I don't interact with students as much. Mm-hmm. So it limits my exposure. However, because, you know, the Madison Plan that's since become the Madison Commitment, and I don't even know if that's the current title because they were looking at that. excuse me, that was, you know, that's out beyond my realm because I deal with mostly workplace issues, mm-hmm. but I do deal with student discrimination complaints. Well, you know, first of all, the number of minority students is woefully lacking and has not increased significantly. Mm-hmm. It simply has not increased since the time I was an undergraduate. That's very disappointing. I'm not close enough to the issue to know why, mm-hmm. But I'm not impressed with that at all. Mm-hmm. I'm not impressed. We're talking about, I mean, I came in 67. We're talking about almost three decades.
Yeah.
This is 94. And for the University of Wisconsin-Madison to have no more students of color as undergraduates than it had almost three decades ago, give me a break.
And when the population is increasing.
Yeah, the populations are increasing. I mean, the country is changing.
Yeah.
You know, we are dealing with Goals 2000, mm-hmm. Even though, unfortunately, the African-American community is dwindling because of killing itself while being aided by government, etc., in terms of weaponry and drugs, mm-hmm. nonetheless, the numbers have not increased. Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason is because financial aid has become much more difficult to gain. And it's no different from when I told you that I didn't go to Denver. I mean, I didn't go to Colorado mm-hmm. because they would have made me rely on loans.
Sure.
And, you know, now we have many more loans than grants and scholarships. And I guess I should add also that as an undergraduate, I was fortunate enough to go through almost my entire undergraduate career on scholarships, grants, and working.
Wow.
I think I had one loan for like $250 or something. But that's because it was available mm-hmm. and because my grade point average was at a point where mm-hmm. I could actually pursue those funds. And that's very different from the situation now. I mean, it's expected that you accumulate a fair amount of debt.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that that's a reason why, that's one reason why the numbers haven't improved. But I don't think it's an excuse. I'm very disappointed. The numbers of African-American faculty increased appreciably under the Madison Plan. Unfortunately, the campus didn't handle the presentation of that well, so I don't think it got the credit it deserved. Mm-hmm. But during the Madison Plan, the numbers of African-American faculty, I think, doubled or tripled compared to what it had been before mm-hmm. in the previous decade.
Yeah.
We compared two decades of figures.
Well, certainly there was...
I am pleased with the numbers, but I think now they're having a difficult retention problem with African-American faculty, mm-hmm. and I think that those numbers are going to come out before too long.
Yeah.
Because there hasn't been an effective effort to deal with retention.
Well, that gives me, now that I realize you're in affirmative action, so I'm going to be dealing with this issue too. Donna Shalhoub had, in the Madison Plan, had a kind of a different way of dealing with it. She put goals, and she said that we want to hire. She gave exact numbers of faculty they want to hire.
And she also gave money.
And money towards doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, and I'm not exactly up on the legality of it, but it seems to me that in terms of affirmative action, colleges and university has been able to get out of a lot of things because of this merit thing for professors. I mean, I'm talking about faculty in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what Donna Shalhoub does as a way that to offset those kinds of things? I mean, you said that UW-Madison did make a significant increase.
It did, in terms of bringing them in.
Uh-huh.
Time will tell whether or not retention was adequate, and I think there are going to be some retention problems.
Certainly.
I think that it's one measure. You know, I wasn't part of the development of that. I came in after the Madison Plan mm-hmm. had been created. I came in just after the Holly Committee and Holly Report, so I wasn't involved directly in any of those. However, I think that the manner in which she did it is one approach. I think that what could have made it stronger was how people actually deal with it. It's not, I'm a big believer in it's not just what you do, it's how you do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm real high on as much prep and planning and as anticipation as you can. Because, you know, lots of things are going to happen that you couldn't plan for. Yes. But I think you're in a better position to respond to them if you've anticipated some things. I found some of the weaknesses with regard to the Madison Plan have to do with the actual way in which people tried to implement it. I mean, you just don't call up a tenured prep professor over in or a professor in another university trying to lure them to Madison and the Madison Plan and only push the race part. That it's the Madison Plan and you have money. I mean, you need to approach them just like any other professor mm-hmm. in terms of their scholarship, in terms of their quality, their reputation, what they can offer to the Madison community. And yes, in addition to that, there is the Madison Plan and this funding. Mm-hmm. But our office received feedback from a number of sources from time to time indicating that it was, you know, that a number of people were put off and chose not to entertain coming to Madison seriously because people were approaching them for their race or their sex exclusively.
To fill a quota.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like I said, it's not just what you do, it's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. Just to close again, it's maybe
did
I can touch on
did we cover all your
it.
Stuff?
Oh yeah.
Okay, good.
And to close, I wanted to get about the legacy of that era. What do you think? I mean, you did mention that we're probably not doing enough talking to younger people.
Yes, so. That's right. I mentioned that. I think that we have not. We may be doing a little better now, but certainly, I mean, as I said, we're talking about almost three decades, mm-hmm. Which is time for two generations, you know, two new generations, if you will, if they're 15 years apart, mm-hmm. Or, you know, 20 years apart, one and a half generations. I think we should share more of our strategies and our experience with younger people so that if they decide to protest or organize, they can benefit from some of the things we did. On the other hand, you know, as has been woven throughout the entire interview, this was a unique time. We had people coming from all over the country. There was a cosmopolitan air. There was an illegal international war. There was a huge protest against that. Mm-hmm. There was the peaking of the civil rights era. I mean, I was also here when King was assassinated, when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, when and John F. Kennedy had already been assassinated. And so we had all of those things jarring the community and jarring the world. And so I think we were able to capitalize on the fact that all these things were happening at the same time. And we didn't have a lot of negative strife within our units, within our ranks.
Yeah.
Which helped considerably. So we were able to cover a lot of ground, and I think that that was, I think we have to recognize how unique that was, and also contrast that to the situation that's developed since that would give rise to the need for a Holly Committee. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the whole student body characteristic had changed purposely. You know, and so when you bring in people from around a state that has no more than, you know, 6% people of color,
yeah,
you're bringing in people who are basically ignorant to African Americans, Hispanic Americans, mm-hmm. Native Americans, Asian Americans. And so I, you know, another thing that's been happening in the last, especially